Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, states and municipalities have a lot of relief money coming from the federal government, but how to spend it wisely? We'll talk about that coming up. But up front, a majority of Pennsylvania voters decided in Tuesday's primary election that they didn't want Governor Tom Wolf or future governors having the sole power to declare an emergency. Voters approved two referendum questions that will end the governor's disaster emergency declaration after 3 weeks and give lawmakers the sole authority to extend it or end it with a simple majority vote. Pennsylvania became the first state in the country to reduce the powers of the governor during the coronavirus pandemic. So what does it mean going forward, and what impact will the other election results have? Joining us is Dr. G. Terry Madonna, political analyst and senior fellow in residence at Millersville University. Dr. Madonna, always good to have you on the program.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Scott, and I'm coming to you from my dining room.
Well, my studio is my basement, so, you know, it's doubling as a studio and a basement.
My studio is my dining room.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Terry, bottom line, were the yes votes in those two referendum questions, were those yes votes a repudiation of how Governor Wolf handled the pandemic, and especially the mitigation of orders and the shutdowns?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way to think about this, Scott, is that Democrats as a whole wanted to shut down the Commonwealth and also activities in other states more quickly and more thoroughly than Republicans. And they wanted to keep them shut down with a variety of restrictions longer than the Republicans. So this became a very, very profound battle between the Republicans who control the legislature in our state and the governor. And it manifested itself, if you will, in question one and question two. Obviously, you're talking about those, and we'll get, I'm sure, further into detail, as huge issues in the state. And the bottom line here is that the voters said what they don't want is the governor to have the kind of exclusive power in dealing with disaster declarations. And that's really what's at the heart of this, which the governor did. And we can talk more about what that meant in practice, if you want.
Yeah, well, let's do that, because sometimes I wonder whether, you know, people, a lot of people actually know what they were voting on. And I'm not saying that they were ignorant of it, but I think that a lot of people looked at this as simply, you know, whether Governor Wolf, they agreed with Governor Wolf's orders during the pandemic and didn't think beyond that. So let's talk about that a little bit. A disaster declaration, what's that mean?
Well, it means that we have a disaster, and the governor, until this amendment, and remember, the ballot questions, as well as the other elections that took place, nominations in our state, are not official until they are certified by the Pennsylvania Department of State, and that takes place on June 7th. Obviously, they're going to be certified. I don't think most elections, I don't think that's even an issue. But you're exactly right. I think it came down to, Governor Wolf has shut down the economy and other social activities, as you and your listeners well know, and whether you favored that or opposed it. I don't think it was aimed at Wolf per se, you know, Wolf the person. It was the exercise of this disaster declaration, which was at issue. And remember this, what Governor Wolf did was what currently he was allowed to do, issue a 90-day, a disaster declaration for 90 days. And what did he do after that initially? He extended it for another 90 days. And what did he do after that? He extended it yet for another 90 days. I think he extended them for more than a year. And guess what? The latest 90 days just expired this week in the state, and the governor took further action, which we can talk about. But you're absolutely right on. It was aimed at Wolf, not sort of Wolf as the person, but Wolf in terms of what he did in dealing with the pandemic.
Now, the governor's response to that would be, and the people who supported the governor's actions would say that Pennsylvania, that the number of coronavirus cases in Pennsylvania did not grow as fast as, say, New York or some of the other places, that overall, if you look at the numbers, Pennsylvania fared pretty well as far as the spread of the coronavirus. But it doesn't seem as though most voters, and remember, we're talking about 54% of the voters, the most voters looked at it that way. They just looked at the mitigation efforts. I want to read a quote to you from Senate Majority Leader Kim Ward, who majority Republican. She said, a yes vote does not take power away from the governor. Rather, it brings back the balance of power by giving the people a say in how to manage their communities during emergency situation. The argument she's making is a classic checks and balances argument. Do you buy it, Terry?
Oh, I think it's both. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that it's checks and balances. And obviously the governor under the current system, 90 days, 90 days, 90 days, as I indicated earlier. So I think it's a combination of both. And for many voters, as we've come out of the pandemic, the belief was that the governor just simply was too slow in opening up the economy and society, and that it should be done more quickly. So, and I mean, I think that many obviously thought that the legislature ought to be involved in the decision making. But look what the first question on the ballot constitutional amendment dealt with. It said that the legislature could literally end, terminate the declaration at any time, literally for any reason, if you get my point. That's that's an awesome authority when you think about it. There's no time attached to that. It just said anytime, at any time, for any reason, and the governor can't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I talk about what the governor's argument would be for to defend his actions, if you want to use that term, defend. But, what Republicans said, and I think a lot of other people here in Pennsylvania, they questioned the inconsistencies in the businesses that closed and were allowed to stay open, that transparency, that the legislature was frustrated that the governor didn't consult with them on a lot of these things, and that there was miscommunication. The vaccine rollout was slow here in Pennsylvania. It's going pretty well now, but the vaccine rollout, I think all those things together, I think a lot of voters looked at those and said, you know what, this something has to change.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct about it. And there was concern in many quarters about the manner in which the economy was shut down. And as you use your word, the inconsistency in what businesses and what could stay open and to what degree. I don't think there's any doubt about that, that played a big role. I think, spending 40 years doing what I'm doing, I think most voters want the legislature and the governor, regardless of party, to be able to sit down and to work out solutions to the problems of the state. Now, we know, and you and I have talked about this on many occasions, we have a conservative legislature and a liberal governor. And they've been able to work out some agreements, to be sure, but they also have very profound differences. And one of the most profound was, what parts of the economy, if any, should be shut down to the degree that Governor Wolf shut the economy and society down. And the same Republicans, many Republicans would argue with the slowness in which the economy was opened. Now, obviously, on Memorial Day, these restrictions end by gubernatorial order, and I don't think that will end the issue, but nonetheless, then, the pandemic in terms of its effect on the economy, is at least legally, is likely to diminish in our state.
You know, but this brings up the larger issue, Terry, just what you described. It seems as though you're right. Governor Wolf and the legislature as a whole, the majority Republicans in the legislature, look at things two different ways. And there was a divide before the pandemic. They had some agreements, and it seemed as though before the pandemic that they were reaching agreement more often. But it seems as though during the pandemic that that gap has grown wider. And you just mentioned something that, you know, that May 31st is when the governor has pointed to as the date when everything can reopen. Yeah, there have been some other legislators. I think of Republican Senator Scott Martin, for example, in Lancaster County, say, how about moving that up 3 days so that businesses that normally have a lot of business during the Memorial Day weekend can take advantage of it. And the governor said, no, we're going to stick to our guns on what we are, our original plan. You know, just as an observer, that moving that up 3 days sounded like a reasonable ask. And the governor said, no, we're going to stick to our three. I mean, I don't know. As an observer, it could look like, no, we're just going to do, I'm not going to agree with you guys. We're going to do it our way.
Yeah. No, of course. I mean, I couldn't agree more. What, 3 days, does it make a big difference? Probably not. I mean, with the large number of folks who have received or who are fully vaccinated or have received the first shot, in fact, the supply has exceeded the demand in terms of the vaccine. It's available now. It's easy to get. Many places you don't even need to sign up for an appointment. You can just show up and get the vaccine. But you're absolutely right. It seemed to me that that was one of the areas that a compromise, a couple of days before Memorial Day, that's a place where it could work out. And just as a factual point, the governor this week issued a 21-day disaster declaration, which deals with question number two that we didn't get to yet, 21 days, which is now, after June 7, when the elections are certified, will be officially added to the Constitution, which allows the governor issue your disaster declaration. You have 21 days. If you go, you can't extend it beyond the 21 days without the legislature's approval. But remember, we already talked about that the governor at any time can terminate the declaration. So we have a number of aspects playing out in this, as you know, and it can get a little complicated. But back to your basic point, yeah, I would have thought that 3 days, you know, one way or another, not going to make a big difference in terms of the spread of the virus.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our guest today, Dr. G. Terry Madonna, political analyst and senior fellow in residence at Millersville University. We're talking about Tuesday's primary election results. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We're at WITF, at Smart Talk. Let me do this again. We're at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Terry, I want to read you another quote. And by the way, these quotes are coming from Spotlight PA. The impact of these amendments should not be viewed solely through the context of the COVID-19 pandemic, as they have far-reaching impacts for all future disasters, regardless of cause. And that was Randy Padfield, director of the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency. And, you know, that, again, that was something that I think kind of got lost in this, is that these are constitutional amendments, and that all future governors, all future legislators, all legislatures, and all future disasters, whether they're storms or hopefully not a pandemic like this again, that that's what changed Tuesday. Once this vote is certified, that's different. It is in the Constitution of Pennsylvania.
Oh, absolutely, and it can affect any disaster that exists in the state. That's exactly correct. I mean, right now we're talking about the pandemic. I think we had something within a couple of months after a guy named Dick Thornburgh became governor where we had Three Mile Island. And you know, it doesn't rule out. I mean, it is a limitation on any disaster declaration for any reason, regardless of what causes a governor to issue a declaration, a disaster declaration. It's in place. So that's exactly correct. And who knows, the next time a governor will say, uh-oh, I need a disaster declaration to deal with this problem. And it applies. And remember, amending the Constitution is no easy task. The Pennsylvania Constitution, two consecutive sessions of the Pennsylvania legislature has to approve it. And then it goes to a referendum, which is what we had on May 18th, a referendum of the voters. I have to qualify that. You could vote by mail earlier, but that's the election day in law.
You know, that's why we're having this conversation on the Friday after the primary rather than the day after, which we typically would have done every year up until this past year. Something else, and I brought this up. I talked with Speaker of the House, Brian Cutler, and it has to do with trust. Trust that the legislature will do the right thing and not think about politics. For example, I brought up to Speaker Cutler, I asked the question, why should Pennsylvanians trust this legislature, a legislature where many members don't wear masks, didn't wear masks during the pandemic, or downplayed the seriousness of the pandemic? And then, of course, where many Republican members, when you talk about certification of votes, wrote a letter to not certify votes from their constituents when Congress was to certify votes. So a lot of people will have to ask, can we trust this legislature or any legislature to do the right thing? I guess you could ask the question, same question about a governor, but you have to look at that.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And what makes this far more complex is the incredible polarization. Again, something you and I have talked about over the last several years. We have a much more polarized society, point number one, point number two, and that translates into office holders, whether we're talking about the legislature or in this case, the governor. And the polarization is so extreme, it makes it difficult to reach a compromise, particularly on, you know, some of the big issues of the day, like the one we're talking about now. And I don't see any cessation of that anytime soon. It looks like it's going to hang around, and it's in Congress. It's in state legislatures all over the country. You're exactly right. But remember, Democratic voters tend to support, you know, Democratic governors. There's a battle going on within the Democratic Party right now between the progressive wing, and the progressive wing won out, by the way, in the mayor's election in Pittsburgh. They won out in the renomination of the district attorney in Philadelphia in a very controversial manner. And the Republicans have their divisions over support for former President Donald J. Trump. But there is no doubt about it that these deep divisions, the polarization, makes it very difficult for Republicans and Democrats to get together. And remember what we're talking about here. Who has authority? Who has authority over such things as an emergency declaration? And the way it works now, until this amendment was added, the governor gets 90 days to deal with it as he sees fit, and he can extend it indefinitely, Scott, indefinitely.
I want to, you know, kind of touch on, it's a good segue, what you just brought up about the mayor's race in Pittsburgh. Of course, in Harrisburg, incumbent mayor Eric Papenfuss lost to council president Wanda Williams. But that mayoral race in Pittsburgh, where Mayor Bill Peduto lost to a more progressive candidate. And, you know, looking at big picture, Terry, that's what concerns candidates today, especially incumbents, the primaries. What more liberal candidates, that more liberal candidates will win Democratic primaries and more conservative Republicans will win Republican candidates. I know we can't make a blanket statement, but it would seem to divide the country even more when you have, and you know, when I say extremes, I just mean that, you know, candidates are more to the left or more to the right, although there are some extremists in both parties. But primaries seem to be dividing this country even more.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And obviously, there are divisions within the party, as we saw. And we were on Tuesday talking about primary elections, you know, to nominate candidates to run in the fall. And because most cities, obviously in Pennsylvania, are Democrats and around the country as well, it's a virtual you know, it's virtually an election in the, you know, a conclusion to the election in the fall. I don't want to end it. It's up to the voters to do that. But I don't think anybody doubts that, for example, that Wanda Williams will end up being the next mayor of the city of Harrisburg. And there is a set of core issues. There's a set of issues right now that are proving, you know, between sort of, let's take the Democrats, it's sort of the party establishment on the one hand and the progressive wing on the other hand. And it has to do with police, police reform, and where that all goes. And also, what are mayors doing to assist poverty in their cities? These were central elements in these, in many of the mayoral primaries, Democratic primaries in our state. And when incumbents lost, whether we're talking about you know, Bill Peduto out in Pittsburgh or Eric Papenfuss in Harrisburg, that's a central issue in those campaigns, if you will.
You know, it makes me wonder, and I go back to even former Senator, the late Senator Arlen Specter, who said that in the U.S. Congress there was no room for centrist candidates or elected officials. Is there room with this divide that we have in this country? Is there room for centrist candidates in this country?
Well, it's very difficult right now because of the polarization that I've been talking about. I mean, in poll after poll after poll, Scott, you have to struggle to find issues that Democrats and Republicans agree on. Make no mistake about it. I mean, the divide is not just 5-10 points in many cases, regardless of the issue that we might be talking about. It's 20, 25, even 30%. That's how deeply divided we are. And I do want to make one other quick comment before we run out of time. Question two now limits a disaster deck on the ballot, the additional amendment, to 21 days, and Governor Wolf issued this week an extension of his disaster declaration for 21 days. It can only be continued with the consent of the state legislature. Now, the 21 days will take us past what? It'll take us past Memorial Day when the restrictions end. You follow my point here? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we'll have to see what the legislature does, you know, anything to limit what the 21-day restriction. I doubt if in fact the legislature will do that.
We have a couple of emails from listeners. Marie says, my concern about this election outcome is now that is that Pennsylvania now will be locked in gridlock, just like the U.S. Congress. Every decision made by the legislature is totally done politically rather than for the needs of the citizens of Pennsylvania. Very sad. Is there that potential, Terry?
Well, yeah, but it's also not either or. I mean, you can have trying to deal with the needs of the people, and you can also have the partisan differences, and that could extend, you know, beyond Governor Wolf. Remember, where Governor Wolf is heading into, and I love this expression, the lame duck period. He can't seek re-election. He's term limited, And as you know from covering Pennsylvania politics for many years, in the final year of a gubernatorial term, particularly with the legislature and the other party, they're not about to give him a big victory. And, well, you know, that aspect works out, you know, regardless of the party and regardless of the governor, for obvious reasons, that they're looking ahead to the next governor. And that's what will take place. We're doing it now, but we'll also do it next year.
Yeah, I saw an opinion piece in a newspaper that had the headline said that Tuesday's vote was the first quack in Governor Wolf's lame duck session. So another email from Michael, who is on the road in the I-81 South. He says, this was so unique, we didn't know what we were facing. Although imperfect, it seems like the governor is trying to find the right balance. Hard to do. In this case, the legislature would take forever to do anything. And I think that that is one of the points that opponents to those referendum questions said, is that you know, the legislature may be called in more frequently, and that's not something they often do. In a few minutes we have left, something I want to bring up, Terry, about Tuesday's election. Now, there were 2 million people who voted in the primary. You know, it's about the same as what we would see in a normal off-year primary. The ballot questions were probably what attracted most people. But other than the ballot questions, what you heard about most often statewide was where there were problems. In York County, not enough ballots. Lancaster County, mail-in ballots with incorrect instructions. First of all, I have to ask, how does that happen after the experiences of last year? That's one thing. But it plays into the hands of those mostly Republicans who want to make changes and, some say, make it more difficult to vote. That even though overall the state said, you know, these are like typical kind of problems that you have in an election, that they were highlighted, they were, you know, that people would say, look at the problems we're having here, and this is a reason that we need election reform. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is when we're going to use mail-in ballots, there's going to be these kind of, I'll call them technical problems that are going to exist because of the nature of mail-in ballots. But the good news is, we weren't talking about extensive mail ballot fraud. That's point number one. Point number two, over in York, they underestimated the number of mail ballots that they would need because of the increased turnout over there. And as you accurately point out, in Lancaster County, they were out of their sequence and putting them, you know, they wouldn't go through the scanner and they have to be counted manually. And so these problems are going to exist as long as we have, and I think they're around to stay, it's around to stay, mail-in ballots. And, you know, they're just going to have to get the system refined over time. This is what, the second election. Now, we've had absentee ballots forever. They're different than mail ballots, which can be used by voters for any reason. Not, you don't need a particular reason in the statutes as you have with absentee ballots. And so I just think these technical questions are going to remain, and there's little that's that, you know, we can probably do. I mean, we'll have you and I'll talk about another mail-in ballot problem in the next election.
Well, okay,
but I do think the legislature and go ahead.
No, what I was going to say, but does that bring up the point that a lot of Republicans are making in states around the country that we are in dire need of election reform?
Oh, look, I think I've always thought there need to be reform in mail-in ballots. I don't understand why under the proper circumstance with both parties having observers and watchers that we can't begin to count those ballots before election day. That never made any, in Florida they did it, 3 weeks in advance last year and didn't have the same problems that we existed here when you get flooded with mail-in ballots. I think there was something like 750,000 folks who used mail-in ballots this year. And you know what will happen in big elections. That number will just escalate, although maybe not because with COVID-19 in recession, so to speak, more people might show up in person. But the bottom line is that system is going to remain. It needs to be go through some reform, which Democrats and Republicans have to agree on.
Well, there some reforms may be needed, and I think the great majority of Pennsylvanians would agree with the one you just talked about, pre-canvassing. Yeah, it makes no sense at all that Pennsylvania has to wait until after the polls close, or excuse me, to election day to count mail-in ballots. Yeah. But the other reforms that many Republicans are proposing is IDs for mail-in ballots, or ID even, to vote in the first place.
In person.
It all comes back to the claims that former President Trump made about fraud when there's like very little fraud to talk about. I think I saw the attorney general said yesterday there was three cases of voter fraud in Pennsylvania in 2020. All three voted for President Trump. So, go ahead.
But you know that has been a big issue with President Trump, and he continues to articulate that fraud. And a large number of Republican voters did not accept the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. Make no mistake about it. And it was literally based on President Trump's continued argument. Widespread fraud. Now, was there some fraud? Sure, but it wasn't widespread. And the serious studies of the issue showed that, yes, there was fraud, but it would not have changed the outcome of the election in the various states.
Mm. Dr. G. Terry Madonna, always like talking to you about politics here in Pennsylvania. Dr. Madonna is political analyst and senior fellow in residence at Millersville University. Terry, good talking with you today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lear.
2 months ago, President Joe Biden signed the American Rescue Plan Act into law. The plan will infuse states with a total of $195 billion in flexible funding. That's in addition to money earmarked for specific areas like education. Local governments will get about $130 billion. Now, this money is certainly welcome to states and municipalities who are experiencing dramatic revenue shortfalls due to the pandemic. But there is caution out there that without careful planning and spending, that states could risk creating future shortfalls. Joining us is Josh Goodman. He's the senior officer and Adam Levin, principal associate with the State Fiscal Health Project at the Pew Charitable Trust, and he's written about this issue. Mr. Goodman, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott. It's great to be with you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So states and local municipalities' revenues, they were hit hard by the pandemic. Businesses closed. Not as many people were working. Many elected officials said that without federal relief, they didn't know what they were going to do. They didn't want to raise taxes, probably couldn't raise taxes, didn't want to lay off workers, but they were looking at cuts in services. It was a real possibility. But they got what they wanted in this money from the federal government. I don't know whether you can answer this question or not, but is this enough money to make up for those losses?
Yeah, I think that's something that varies from state to state. And one thing we've really seen is wide variation on how states were affected. And so the tourism-dependent states like Hawaii and Nevada obviously were hit really hard economically just because people weren't traveling, whereas other states have done reasonably well. We recently published some data showing how state revenue has performed in the 12 months that began March 2020 compared to the 12 months earlier. And actually, not adjusting for inflation, state revenue is up ever so slightly. But as I said, there's a lot of variation. So states like Pennsylvania are still down in terms of revenue. And that's not even accounting for the inflation and the growth in spending demands that has come with the pandemic for in areas such as public health. So states, at least temporarily, are in a much better position than they were before they got this money. But not everyone is just sort of in the clear now.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about Pennsylvania, not just Pennsylvania, but states like Pennsylvania. As you said, the challenges facing states, they're all different. Pennsylvania is getting older. The population isn't growing as fast as, say, a state like Texas or like Florida. I mean, we've recently lost with the census, we've recently lost a congressional seat. So what plans should a state like Pennsylvania have with an older demographic and population not growing as quickly as others? What kind of plans should they have for this money?
Right. Pennsylvania is one of a handful of states that has some of the deeper, longstanding budget problems around the country. Maybe not quite to the degree of an Illinois or a New Jersey or Kentucky, some of the really fiscally challenged states. But there are a few ways you can see that. One is in the state's reserves. Pennsylvania has one of the weakest funded rainy day funds in the country. And that's important because when you have a sudden crisis like the pandemic, states rely on their reserves. It's really the best line of defense they have. And so in this moment maybe of calm where Pennsylvania is getting all of this federal money, it's a great time to take a long-term view and look at, okay, this money needs to be spent by obligated by the end of 2024. Well, what's our budget going to look like in 2025? What tax revenue will we collect? What will our spending demands be based on things like the demographic changes that you mentioned? And that can really inform what Pennsylvania does. The last thing the state wants to do is, spend on ongoing expenses that once you get to 2025, there's going to be this cliff where the federal money runs out and the state won't be able to afford its commitments.
I had to smile when you said this moment of calm. What is that? Anyway, you write that the lessons that can be learned from how states handled relief money from the federal government in 2009 after the Great Recession are there. What are some of those lessons?
Sure. So just to bring all your listeners back, during the Great Recession, there was Congress acted kind of similar to as they did this time, where there was generous federal relief for state governments. Most of the flexible funds in that case ran out at the end of fiscal year 2011. And states really weren't ready for what came after that. There was a slow recovery. They hadn't really prepared their budgets. In some cases, there were federal rules that made it a little harder for them to prepare. And so what you had was like this new round of budget cuts. And you can see this in a number of areas. State workforces, if you take out the education workers, actually kept dropping in 2012 and 2013. Higher education funding continued going down. And so years after the Great Recession ended, states were still cutting back, and that was what contributed to the slow economic recovery that America experienced. And so one thing that's really been gratifying to see is around the country, wide recognition from state officials who are saying, we can't let that happen again. We have to think about what are some one-time expenses we can use this money on that will really provide us a lot of value, but that won't have large ongoing costs after the federal money runs out. So that could be things like investments in infrastructure and technology, broadband infrastructure is a big topic of conversation with this money. It could mean sort of unwinding some of the budget maneuvers that states used to kind of get through the last year. So Pennsylvania is a state that borrowed from the federal government for its unemployment insurance trust fund. And one thing states can use this money for is to pay off that borrowing so they don't have that kind of on their books going forward. And if they have problems in a few years, then they have the option of borrowing again.
You know, something that when you're talking about those one-time cost, I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking of this the wrong way, but I guess I'm thinking of it in some type of logical order. Like, what would the spending priorities be? Would they be filling the gap that the deficits that states ran up? Pennsylvania was, you know, $3 to $5 billion at you know, different times during the pandemic. Fill those budget gaps, the spending that was already allocated for before the pandemic, and then move on to some of these one-time projects, and then maybe, you know, finding other ways to look down the road. I mean, am I thinking of that logically, or is that how it should happen or not?
You know, it's interesting you say that, because the federal law itself kind of lays out that hierarchy in a way where state governments have a lot more flexibility on how they use this money if they experienced revenue losses, and to the extent they experienced revenue losses. So, you know, states' primary revenue sources are personal income taxes and sales taxes, and those were affected by the pandemic. And so most states have some degree of revenue loss, especially if you adjust for inflation. And states really have a lot of leeway, if they had those revenue losses, to use that money to fill those budget holes. And then they can, but if they didn't, then they have to sort of move on to the specific categories that the law lays out. And what our research shows is states want to make their budgets sustainable over the long term. That, you know, you don't just want to have schools this year. You want them in 10 years and 20 years, and you need to be able to educate people then. You don't want to just have roads now. You need them, you know, in the future and everything like that. And so getting back to a place where your kind of your budget is structurally balanced is an important first step with this money. When you have a downturn, states have all these strategies they use. They delay payments, they accelerate revenue collections, they might move money around where you have a fund that's for some specific purpose. Well, pull that into the general fund so we have money to balance our budget. And all those kinds of maneuvers are things that are kind of one-time actions that once you do get a better budget situation, you need to undo them or else they'll not be there next time, and you'll be more likely to make some of those deeper, more painful either tax increases or spending cuts.
Now, when you talk about paying down debt, and you mentioned that Pennsylvania was one of the states that I believe there were 20 that borrowed from the federal government for unemployment compensation, but states like Pennsylvania have borrowed for other things, have debt for other things. One I think of in particular here in Pennsylvania is a huge debt for pensions of former public employees and former educators. On the local level, municipalities have the same issue. School districts have the same issue, that we have these huge pension debts out there. Can this money, it may not be the sexiest thing to do, but can this money be used for those debts, for example?
Under the federal law, there are certain explicit things states can't do with the money that are listed. And one of them is to pay down pension debt. And I think the theory behind that is the idea of this money is to solve the problems states have had over the last year from the pandemic, both the public health challenges and the economic challenges, rather than to respond to these longer term challenges. Now, that being said, the advantage states have with this money, and the reason I called it a period of calm, even though for most of us at home, it doesn't feel that calm, is states' budget situations are likely to be better this year and next year than they have been in a long time, because we have strong economic growth projected, at least, and there's all this federal money. And so to the extent the federal aid helps states, you know, pay for other things they want to pay for, that can free up some money to deal with other kinds of debt, such as pension debt. And so even if you can't just take those federal dollars and put it straight into your pension system, it might give you the flexibility to make some of those investments and to get into a better place over the long term.
So what you're talking about when you say that states need to take the long-term view, unfortunately, many legislatures don't take a long-term view. That, I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard in the past 20 years, smoke and mirrors, when the state comes up with a budget, that they move things around, one-time deals, you know, don't want to raise taxes, don't want to lay people off, and but you know, the spending continues to rise. So my question is there? It will take responsibility, it will take discipline on the part of states to think long term when they haven't done it historically in the past. How do you get them thinking that way?
Yeah, that's a great question. And just sort of the cycle that lawmakers operate on does tend to you know, lead them to this shorter term mindset where they're writing a budget every year or every 2 years. And so how are we going to balance this budget is the question. You know, they're up for election regularly, and obviously they want to show results before that. There are a few things that can help. One, you need to have the data that if you don't know what the problem is, it's really easy to push it to the side. And that's where doing some of this analysis of what does your budget look like over the long term, taking into account, you know, the growing costs like pensions, taking into account demographic trends. What does it mean that our population is aging? Maybe that means we have to pay less for schools because we're going to have fewer school children, but maybe it raises all these other costs that we have, like healthcare costs. And, you know, what are some of the temporary things that are going on, like the federal funds, that we need to account for? Beyond having that data, I think it's just sort of getting the conversation to change where people are, you know, holding lawmakers accountable for the long-term picture. And so it's really up to everyone, people like me who study state government, journalists who cover state government, and the lawmakers themselves to remember that the long-term picture is important. And as I mentioned, you know, one thing that's kind of been nice to see with this money is compared to 10 years ago, I'm seeing a lot more recognition of we need to be ready when this money expires. This is one-time money. This is temporary money, and you know, we need to have a plan in place. And so I think some of that stuff is starting to get through. It just takes time, and there are always new lawmakers coming in, and so there's this constant process of educating the new group of people.
Yeah, we ran into that situation 10 years ago here in Pennsylvania when money went to schools and then it wasn't there the year after, and it had been used to put into budget. So that was something that did happen. We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank you very much. You mentioned infrastructure needs. I wonder whether there may be a temptation from some states to hold off on infrastructure because the Biden administration is working on an infrastructure plan now.
Yeah, I think that's one of the questions states are really grappling with this money. With this funding, as I mentioned, it's specifically water, sewer, broadband infrastructure that's permissible. And then for those states that had revenue losses, they can use it on more broadly on things like roads. But a lot of states have been talking about infrastructure with this money. But certainly they have in the back of their mind that additional money that might come through. I think one important point is states don't have to decide everything right now. And I'm seeing a lot of cases where states are saying, all right, we'll make a plan for half of this money this year. But next year, you know, 2022, we'll come back and make a plan for the other half of it. And that would be one strategy if you're not sure what Congress is going to do on infrastructure, to hold off. And then if there isn't additional funding for that, you could always dedicate more of this money for infrastructure next year.
Again, only about 30 seconds, but there will be states that will have surpluses, and you know, there is the possibility that some will say, oh, we're rolling in money and spend on new projects. 30 seconds or less. You don't recommend that?
I think states can do that if they look ahead to 2025, and if they actually have a surplus even without the federal money, that'll free up some, then they have that leeway to invest in ongoing programs. But you can't know whether you'll be able to afford that unless you've done the analysis. And that's really what we're telling states to do.
Josh Goodman is a senior officer, and Adam Levin, principal associate with State Fiscal Health Project at the Pew Charitable Trust. Mr. Goodman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for the conversation.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.